Under normal circumstances? No, right. And the majority of the compartments are in your extremities. You have 46 throughout your body, but 38 of those are really in your extremities, and most of those in your lower legs. So that's where we would expect to see a lot of the crush injuries. With compartment syndrome, what you're going to get is again, pain disproportionate to the injury, so it's extensive pain. It gets much worse. They have sensory deficit first where they can't feel, sense anything, and then eventually they'll lose. Pulses are a late sign because your arterioles, you're still getting blood flow, you're just not getting adequate flow, and you don't have complete compression.
So no pulse is a late sign.
Late sign, right, because the arteriole is not completely compressed yet. That's why you still have those pulses. If you lost the pulses immediately, then you already have significant compartment syndrome and you have a lot of pressure in there. And that can happen with a really bad injury, you know. But this compartment syndrome is something that usually develops over a little bit of time. Very tense, very swollen. Again, you have an elevated compartment pressure and the muscle is going to get weaker and weaker. You might send them for a CAT scan, but usually what we do right away is try to get you put the needle in to get the compartment pressure. Sometimes they already know what they have. They usually just bring them right to the OR, and doing the fasciotomy is the only way to relieve that pressure. Send a picture around so you can see it looks like a pretty gruesome surgery, but that's the only way to relieve that pressure is to slice down the muscle and relieve that pressure. They will have full function, though, once they have it done, although it cosmetically doesn't look very nice. They usually will regain most of the function as long as that compartment pressure was relieved within a reasonable amount of time. The longer the pressure builds up, the more damage and long-term disability they might have. We've had people that even runners, a lot of people too with the flying on planes, a lot of the athletes, they have to be really careful when they run a race. If you don't let your muscles relax, then you go up in a plane and you go up in a high altitude. That too can also cause a compartment pressure to occur. And that has happened to a good friend of mine who was a good runner. She did fine, but didn't know what it was. And here she was a nurse, too, and didn't even realize that she should have let the, so it's always good to let the muscle relax, cool yourself down with workouts.
So that's another testament for the value of stretching and cooling and all of that kind of thing.
Right, letting things really cool down. You had brought up a good point. You had a patient that had the rod put in their hip that had broken after they tried to remove it. During he had it in, I guess, surgically implanted for how long before it?
I'm not really sure, but he told me it was a good amount of time, more than 6 months or something. He had a motorcycle accident, and he basically, that whole side just, he said he could see this here,
out.
And the blood was just really squirting out, he said, and when after finally after therapy and everything, when they tried to get out, it was only half the rod, and the doctor just wanted to explain how that rarely happens.
Yeah, it usually doesn't happen that the rod will break, especially when you're trying to remove it. But as long as the bone healed properly, otherwise they might have to re-break it and re-rod it. But hopefully.
That's always a real step back when people have to face that.
Right.
When the orthopedic person says to them, well, we're going to have to refracture or re-break and then do this, and it's like, oh, no, talk about one step back.
Right.
It feels like a dozen steps backwards when you start that whole rehab process again,
It's
by that time they've already lost sometimes weeks, sometimes months of their normal functioning life, and this is back to square one. It's very discouraging.
Yeah, it definitely is, but that's rare that the rods are made so well nowadays that I'm surprised it broke. But what was he doing though too? That no excessive force, hopefully that.
Somehow, when he came down, he went back up, the thigh muscles tensed so much that something popped in his knee, and he was on the floor, and they were immediately there. And what had happened was he's very muscular, and his thigh muscles were so large and so strong by that time, by everything he was doing, that it
Wow.
And
hopefully didn't hit his popliteal artery.
The orthopod, and he ended up obviously in the emergency, and the x-ray was very clear, and the orthopod came in there to see him, and we were there, and it was, Andy was sitting there, laying there like, oh no, I don't want to hear this stuff. And the guy explained how everything was. He said, this is rare, but it does happen. It happens when you have large muscles. And he said, you were almost too good in your therapy, and when your muscles contracted, it put force on
they can snap. Way, yeah, they snap.
And it pulled that bone apart. So that had to be redone. It took two more surgeries to do things. So that going back to square one is discouraging. In those
does he still have full weight of bearing on that leg? Or?
Yeah, he's okay.
Yeah, it's amazing what they can do now. Yeah, a lot of cosmetic. And even that sometimes now has got better with the arthroscopic, the different surgeries they can do. But it's amazing that what can happen. This was just a picture. You can't see the back of that. I just thought you might want to see that. Some people had asked me what the CAT scan looks like. And it's, you know, it's only about so wide. And it's like a little, you know, just in this little area here is where the CAT scan is being taken in the radioactive materials. And it's a very low amount are being shot. So if you're getting the head would go in first, and then the patient just slides through there. And then if they get the neck or the chest, is any area they need, they'll just continue to move them through there. The stretcher is on, you know, a rotating type of machine that just moves them through. So they don't have as much claustrophobia in this as they would get with the MRI. CAT scan. Yeah, this is the CAT scan. Okay, so what are our nursing interventions for any type of, whether it be compartment syndrome, any musculoskeletal type of injury? You always want to control the bleeding first. Direct pressure is still the best way to stop bleeding. We don't encourage tourniquets. Usually we can stop bleeding with direct pressure. And what else can we do? Pressure points, right. Very important to know where those pressure points are because that can make a big difference. And you may have to hold for quite a while. The brachial one, you know where that one is, the femoral. And it can make a very big difference. You want to splint it and immobilize it. When you splint it, immobilize, you want it above and below where the suspected injury is. And then after you put your splint on and immobilize, you always want to check your neurovascular status again because sometimes our splinting impairs their perfusion or you need to splint it in an area, better way that it gets full function and gets good blood flow. We do apply the ice for comfort, usually first 24 to 48 hours after, even 24 hours. Ice really is not, other than comfort measures, going to do much for them. Elevate the extremity, relieve some of the pressure. You've seen in the hospital, they have all different types of things where sometimes it's like an arm may be hanging up in the air to help the swelling. And we never want it, you know, too far above the level of the heart because then you're not going to get any blood flow to that extremity. Medications, they're using a lot of pain, so you want to be real judicious with their pain medication. Anybody who's been on the orthopedic floors already, you know that most of those people are in continuous pain and will need that to be, you know, regulated for them. You don't want to wait until the pain gets intense because keep it regular in the first, at least, right after surgery, post-op, or they've had an injury. You want to really be...
On Brennan 5, but they didn't have any protocols on the floor or anything, but that started in the OR, right?
OR, it's also done in the emergency room. You can have a nerve block done. And literally just need an IV started, and then they'll give you the nerve block right into wherever they're... My son actually had it done in his fingers. Yeah. He had the door closed on his hand at school. And they called me, and they said, you know, crushed his fingers. I'm thinking, cut his finger. I'm thinking, wow, how bad could it be at school? It was an aftercare, you know, it was 3 o'clock. And they were running through the door, and he had his fingers right in the jam, and it caught these two fingers. And luckily, right where the crease was, but they were crushed. One was hanging on by a thread, and the other one was. So they gave him the nerve block, and they did it, started like right up in here.
And you said IV and nerve block. They're two different.
Well, the nerve block, they inject right into the.
They put it right there,
directly into
directly
it.
There.
Directly in, right. Not through the IV fluid, directly into the. Into the finger, whatever area they want to completely block. Now, that was done with the hand. Usually they'll do anything else other than fingers and hand, they like to do in the OR where it's a little more controlled.
Right. I saw a fellow there. We ended up not having him last week who just had total knee the day before. And he said, I'm fine. No pain whatsoever, but I had to block.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to some of the nurses and they said sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work.
So right. He did very well. You know, the hand surgeon felt that he could tolerate it, and that's why he didn't want to put him under anesthesia. And that's the whole reason, too.
Right.
You avoid having anesthesia if you can do the nerve block, do the procedure, And then within a couple hours, they're absolutely fine. He
and
went home.
It makes sense for older people who might have all kinds of cardiac or respiratory
right.
problems, but have this joint replacement mm-hmm. done, and if they can handle the pain that way,
right.
it's much better.
It definitely is. They gave him some sedates. They gave him morphine before. They gave him the nerve block to relax him and make him comfortable. And then he said it did, you know, hurt.
How long did it last?
A couple of hours.
Would that be, it would differ, I guess, depending on how much they put in? Do they, like,
period of time to do the procedure, and I guess unless the procedure takes longer than they expect, because some people do, it takes a little longer, and then but they usually won't do a nerve block in the emergency room unless they know it's going to be a quick procedure. Now his took probably an hour by the time he was finished with. He got 40 stitches,
yeah.
And he ended up suturing. Taking the nail off, and I was like, "Well," but once he gave him the nerve block, we were like, ugh. But he didn't feel a thing, absolutely nothing other than the initial shot. And what they do now, they take your nails off, and then they place one had already fallen off, the other one was just hanging, so he pulled them off, but they put them back in place, just rest them there, because it acts as a splint as the fingers were healing, and then your nail will grow back, and his nail grew back completely, and then that dead nail just fell off. And he just has a little tiny crease in two of his nails.
How old was
he? He was 9 when that happened. So he didn't lose any function.
So how was he afterwards? Did he have to keep it elevated?
He had to keep it elevated for a while. He just splinted it, the hand. He didn't have to have a sling or anything, just pain medication. And he was very lucky that it was above where the crease was, so he didn't do a lot of nerve damage. He has some tingling in the one finger. He's sensitive to the temperature, but no loss of function and been absolutely fine. But that's the nerve blocks that we've done in the emergency room. But the OR is a little more extensive. For the knee, I don't know if they do for the knee. Usually,
that's what this guy had, and he had a lot of cardiac problems and stuff, and so they had done that.
Yeah, what we do a lot is the conscious sedation in the emergency room a lot, and I don't know if they do it that often even on the floor. It's like if you have a dislocated hip or you have a dislocated shoulder or a dislocated hip, they'll give you conscious sedation where they just load you up with, like Verse said, medication to just totally relax you, and then they'll pop whatever back in place. Then we just monitor you a couple hours so that wears off, and then off you go. Same thing.
Do they consider dislocations of, say, hips or shoulders as an orthopedic emergency because of all the vascular
yes.
tissue
mm-hmm.
damage
yes.
that can be done? Mm-hmm. Do they want to get those muscles relaxed right away and get that back in?
Right. We usually try to reduce that as quickly as possible. So that's someone that we wouldn't put back out in the waiting room, if you can help, or try to get them right in. More so the hip.
Anesthesiologist in the ER?
No, the ER physician, the nurses. We give the sedation. The nerve block. The surgeons do that. The hand surgeon did that one for my son. He himself put in the nerve block, and so would the ER doctors. Rarely do it. It's usually more the surgeons that come down. It's usually more reconstructive type of thing. But it was questionable even with him with when you go to the OR. If they thought he had more nerve damage or he had more involvement other than extensive soft tissue, they probably would have taken him to the OR. So that's usually when they decide OR versus...
Based on their assessment.
Based on their assessment, right. And, the nurse, it went back for it. They gave him the antibiotics for everything that we talked about, the IV fluids. They gave him the antibiotics right away, made sure his tetanus was up to date, and prepared him. You always want to prepare him as though they might be going. And we were lucky that surgeon came in, within an hour or so. We were out of the emergency room within 5 hours, which is unheard of, when you don't want to have to have anything done. So we were very lucky that day. If you want to prepare them for definitive stabilization, so they're going to be admitted to the hospital and maybe they're going to have their surgery done the next day. They don't always have it right away. Psychosocial is very important because it's devastating to have any kind of injury like that. Again, it could be your livelihood. Usually very painful and certainly most times an unexpected event that caused it. Preparing for operation, admission, and sometimes they have to be transferred. And we do a lot of, we are more of a receiving facility at Jersey Shore, but there are times we do also send people out. So there may be a hospital where they have the resources or specialty services that patient needs and you need to get them transferred. So sometimes they go right from the emergency room to the other hospital, or you may be taking care of them on the floor. Did you have anybody transferred when you were?
Right. Like all their initial stuff. And then
Right, the ambulance comes, picks them up, so you have to, you know, have your assessment, all your documentation done, have them prepared for transport. There's a form that we all fill out. There's a whole procedure for transferring out. And if you do get a chance, it would be good to see how that's done. Yes, case management's already set it up, right, and prepared everything. MTALA, yes, and MTALA is a biggie, and especially to a student nurse, is make sure that, you know, you're not given a lot of responsibility with that, because it's a major legal liability, and it'd be one thing left out, and it's a big lawsuit for the hospital. So usually the nursing supervisor is involved at some hospitals with that, check it before they go. Sometimes, you know, the charge nurse has to sign it. But try to see how the form is filled out. Nursing-wise, we're always concerned with immobility, that patients are going to have skin breakdown. If you're in pain, people usually don't want to move. They usually, with pain and discomfort, will try to lie still. But it's not good to be perfectly still. The more immobile you are, it sets you up for, you know, your whole bowel habits are going to be decreased. And then we also load them up with pain medication. And the pain medication, one of the primary side effects of pain medication is to slow down that gastric and intestinal motility. So we want to keep a good eye on that. You know, it sounds funny, but we really want to know when their last bowel movement was, because we don't want to find out 4 days they haven't had a bowel movement. Now they're going to go septic because we didn't keep an eye on that. So they're usually right away put on stool softeners. That's why we try to get them moving when we can, give them lots of fluids, make sure their diet's good.
When I was doing this concept map, and one of the things was constipation that I had, and like you said, how many days can you go without having bowel movement before it's, like, you know, we had to put them in order of importance.
Right. Well, after 2 days, we start to get concerned. By four, it's a major concern. Yes, yeah. It should be going every day. So, you know, you give it 2 days because you're immobile and with pain medication. But after that, and then also that's why, too, we also got to remember when did they eat last. That's what we also want to find out. Because if you haven't eaten, you've been NPO for 2 days, you're not going to be going, you know, like you would if you had your regular diet. So every patient's a little different depending on what their status is, but after
the pain that it could cause. We had a patient over the weekend. She's completely bedridden, but she was eating. She could eat, but all of a sudden she decided to say, "Oh, by the way, I haven't had a bowel movement in 4 days," and started having this awful pain. So we just impacted her.
Yeah.
I never saw so much stool in my life. You couldn't even imagine that it was, and it was formed.
Mm-hmm.
So her whole colon, it had to be just like.
It's very uncomfortable. Yeah. Very uncomfortable. They get bloated. You know, it's a lot of pain. You figure they're already uncomfortable from their injury. Now they're talking about.
What age person was it?
She was about 62 years old. She's been with multiple problems, and just diagnosed with lung CA. So was dealing with a lot of issues.
Was
but
this on? Was
no, this is at work.
Some other.
At work, and she, I guess all the other issues, she never thought to say, well, by the way.
Yeah.
I was telling how important it is to keep track of when they've had their last bowel movement, especially with our musculoskeletal, because they're immobile, they're on the pain medication.
They asked
the time-wise. I said at least 2 days, start being concerned. We always document in the ICU, we have to put on the top of our chart in red when their last bowel movement was, because you can go septic, get impacted.
Yeah.
It just, I just never thought it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then once they even gave her the they couldn't give her the other ones because she was also CHF, diabetes, you know,
right.
The whole thing. So
right.
You have to be so careful.
You have to be very careful with that.
When
they
give
her colates?
Well, they were given, but it wasn't working.
It just piled up.
Was so formed, like just like you could see it, the whole colon.
It was like plaster cast.
Yeah, and then once she finally was able to do it herself,
right.
It was just like solid, just coming out. Even imagine all that was even. Plus, she was eating.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wasn't like she wasn't eating either. Like she was eating. So now all her meals.
A primary thing that nurses have to have in their mind, even if you don't want to think about bowel function, you have to think about bowel function for all of your patients, particularly in this.
Right, these type of patients can't move. They don't want to move. They're in pain, and they know every time they get on the bedpan, it's going to hurt. You have the fracture pans. Try to encourage them to use the. Fracture pans have it's got a little cushion, but it's flat on one end. It's a lot smaller than the big bed pan, and you can kind of get it under there a little more comfortably without, you know, causing their hips and their legs to really be moved. But encourage them to go. usually when people first come into the hospital, they always have to go to the bathroom, and then after that, they can't go for a while. So you want to keep an eye on that. Circulatory and respiratory impairment, always keep doing that neurovascular assessment of that, whatever, wherever their injury is. And then a lot of times they start physical therapy as quickly as possible because we don't want them to have further breakdown of those muscles. And usually that wouldn't be a nursing job, but you would be maybe be aware when the physical therapist is coming. Sometimes the patients get some pain medication before therapy so that they're a little more interactive with it. And we as nurses, we really need to encourage them how important that is. Respiratory-wise, their deep breathing is very important. Breathing into the little incentive spirometer a couple times a shift is really, really important too, because we don't want them to get pneumonia, you know, survive their musculoskeletal injury, but then develop a serious case of pneumonia. With some of the other patients too, just to be aware, patients that have had anesthesia, and especially the elderly, it does take a long time for that to wear off, and some of them turn into completely different people for a while. And one of the most interesting things I ever had when I worked in orthopedics was taking care of the patients who had anesthesia, and you're like, you know, they had you believing that they were seeing stuff out the window, there's somebody behind the door. They do have a lot of hallucinations, and you really want to keep them safe, though, too, because those are the patients that will fall out of bed accidentally, try to get up and go to the bathroom, jump out the window. You really have to keep a good eye on that and make sure that they're safe. Traction and pin care, if you have anybody who has the pin care, you need to make sure that's clean. There's a good route for infection to take place with the pins. We still use the normal saline and hydrogen peroxide with either gauze pads. Sometimes they like you to irrigate it. Have they had a chance to really?
Will you?
Usually it's just because it burns if you use all straight peroxide, but it does burn a little bit. But they get fairly used to it after a while, and that's why sometimes you just irrigate it, pour it on, and they tolerate it pretty well. Skeletal traction, those pins are really very secure. I have a nice picture of someone later that you can see an external fixator, which is pins right through the pelvis. I mean, they can literally pick themselves up with that. That's how stable that is. But it's, you know, it's in there pretty far, and you have to always be concerned with infection and then the osteomyelitis going through
the
bone. That is the way we do move them, yeah.
They pick up
right.
The external
you can't.
Ends and stuff.
Isn't that a baby?
It doesn't hurt them.
It looks awful.
You should see the way they wiggle around with that on, too. That doesn't seem to affect them at all. So it doesn't hurt once it's in and its skeletal pins are in.
Remember what I said, I think I said it to this group, about sexuality and orthopedic? This is the floor, you know, that can have a lot of young people on it who have this accident and are suddenly immobilized. It doesn't mean their life stops. Just based on my own personal experience, always knock before you go in the room.
Yeah. Excuse me, I'll come back.
Didn't bother anything.
No, it doesn't bother some of them. So don't make a habit of picking them up by that, but if you have to and you need that as a support or a leverage area, you can. It's very, very stable. You know, check the traction equipment frequently. Things can move. You know, things can get loose. You have traction techs in most of the hospitals, a little check. You have the weights at the end of the bed. I have a box traction here that some of you may have seen. This is the one that goes on the foot. So this would be for a hip or a femur to immobilize them. It's called Buck's traction. And you'll see at the end of the bed it has a little trapeze. So what happens is you put the foot goes right in here. The foot would be right in there. And then at the end of the bed then would be the weight. No, they don't have pins with that. Not usually. Sometimes they put them in. They may have had pins put in after surgery, but they don't usually. It's just, you see this a lot.
Right. This is a way of at least keeping it somewhat in alignment.
And sometimes afterwards, during the healing process. Yes. Yeah, they slide right out, so you have to make sure one, you know, it's just Velcro that it's on nice and tight. It has the three straps. On here then would be a little hook, and then there'd be a weight, and that would hang freely at the end of the bed. You can bet, though, you're going to hit that weight at least once during your shift. And then at the end of the bed, or is to hold that in, is a long rod with little knobs on it. And if you didn't hit that once during your shift, you're lucky too, so just be careful. But this, when you take them for any procedures, though, just remember you got to take that weight off, you know, because you don't want to be going down the hall with that weight swinging and catching on whatever. Mary B., and also when they're in the bed and the traction's on, you want to make sure that weight is hanging freely. It shouldn't be resting on anything or a pillow, or because you're not going to get the full effect. It's usually 5 pounds, 10 pounds. The doctor will write how much weight they want. Did you have somebody on?
A little tiny elderly person, they can just go right down.
Yeah, they just slot. Right. Keep an eye on that.
Oh,
if you want to see it, we can. Yes, no, usually not with any kind of skeletal traction pins. Right? It's usually done before surgery and then sometimes after just to make sure that they stay immobilized. Skin care, toileting, and turning is very important. Skin care, they're going to get skin breakdown very quickly. Laying in the same spot, you know, where your devices are, your cast, any type of splinting, it's going to cause breakdown areas. So be very careful with that. We've had a lot of patients, even with a collar, cervical collar, they can get breakdown in their chin area and the back of their occipital area. Turning them regularly, they can be turned. A lot of them think they can't be turned because they have an injury, but yes, they can turn. So, you know, skin care, back rub, and pulmonary toileting, you know, give them a good little chest PT when you can. Medical management would include more of our reduction. They may have to have surgery to reduce the bone fragments, put them back in anatomical alignment, and with that always comes pain associated. Closed reduction is more of our conscious sedation where we just relax them, we mentioned before. Even with fractures, it doesn't have to be a dislocation. Sometimes they will do a conscious sedation just to put a bone back in the ER, have an orthopedic doctor come in, they'll do it, cast, you know, mobilize them and know if they go. The immobilization, I was going to show you, there's different types. We mentioned the other day that Addis splint, which is what we use now. It comes in a little pack like this, and if pass around, and they're called, these are called one-step splints. When they're in the bag, you can feel they're nice and soft. Once you dip, what they'll do is take them out of the bag, and then they'll conform it. Now, this one's already been out, so it's got wet. They'll conform it. Like I said, if I had a fractured arm, they'll bend it right in place. It'll be wet, and then as it dries, it'll...
Is that what it looks like?
When it's dry, that's what it looks like. Oh, I guess we can open one. Yeah, this is what it looks like when it's dry, and you can see how hard it is, the bottom, but now it's really soft. You can mold it any way you want. So here's a wet one. Before, and they dip it in water. We dip it in warm water, mold it to wherever it has to go, and then wrap an ACE bandage around it, and it conforms right into place. And these are the new casts or splinting we put on initially, and then eventually they may have a hard cast put on. You can see there's all
that replaces, remember that years ago, those metal ones with the styrofoam underneath? Like if you broke your finger, you had that big bulky, it was metal and it bent and it had like the foam underneath.
We still have those too. No. Still use those, yes. We still. Yeah, it depends. Yes. Yeah, they put it on wet. Yes. It's still wet. Right. They dip it in water. They put it exactly where it has to go. Like yesterday, somebody had a radius and an ulna fracture. She had it put from here all the way up to her elbow, molded that right to it, and then wrapped it with an ACE gauze. You always want to have the fingers so that they can wiggle their fingers and have some function. So you don't want them out like that. Usually we'll do it just like that. Sometimes put even a gauze pad right in there.
Now, you do that? The nurses do that? Assist the surgeon?
No, usually the techs do that. We have a tech in the emergency room who helps the orthopedic surgeons. We also have an orthopedic tech in the emergency room who comes in for anything advanced, but otherwise, or technical, but otherwise our techs do that. Now, we as nurses do assist a lot with putting the splints on. A lot of times they need us to.
The techs are very good with the pulleys and the weights. And
yes.
Setting the beds up and the complex kinds of things.
Right.
That's what they do. They're very focused.
Yes, and they're very well trained with that. You know, most times the nurse is really just too busy doing 1,000 other things, but the you know, we're usually medicating them while they're putting that. But sometimes you're the only one there that can help, and it can and move things along a little bit more. That's the one step, and then you just wrap the gauze around it. And then they usually follow up with their orthopedic doctor, and then they may keep that on for a week, 2 weeks, and then change it over to the regular fiberglass cast that we're used to seeing that comes now in about 10 different colors. So they're never the same. The splint you're talking about, we still have the metal splints with the foam on them. We still use those. We still have this one is a hand splint. Is that what you meant that you had? They don't always need the hard cast sometimes. Now, the girl we put that on with that arm, she was going to the OR the next day. So, you know, you always have enough, too, so they can cut right up, take it off, and then allows room for the swelling, too. So these really do work well. This is another type of immobilization. This would be going on the hand, and you could see how it just...
like a carpal tunnel.
Right. And it has the rods in here that they can remove, and that's hard. So then you put it, you know, away from the fracture just to mobilize it. That's just another different type.
And that's for fractures?
Fractures, right. Carpal tunnel, sprains, strains. It really is physician preference and depending on what type of injury that you might have. This is one we use for the ankle. Has anybody ever had one of these? Some, a lot of us probably have these. I had several of these. I had sprained my ankle several times. Yes. These work very well. Goes right on the side of the ankle, even shows you which way to have your foot in case you forget. Now, they do have a little port in here that you can, it has a little extension hose on it, like almost like oxygen tubing, and you put it in there and you inflate it with air, and it inflates these. You can have more of like an AM, a little more conforming to. We don't really do that a lot because sometimes it puts too much pressure on. You know, you just want it supported. You don't want it compressed, so... it's rarely done when you inflate it with the air, so a lot of times we don't even inflate it because it's more dangerous for people to start blowing it up with air and not. But a lot of people keep this afterwards, even once you've healed and when you participate in different sports. I still wear it as a protective device. I don't know if do you still wear yours once in a while when you do anything.
No.
You don't do anything. So she's had the femur, ankle. What else did you have? Yeah. Yes.
And we could think, people tend to think of that as, oh, nothing. But really, it needs to have the rest that immobilization like this can give it.
It really does. And you know what? If you get back on it too soon, you can look at my foot and see a perfect example of what you should, you know, because you have a lot of vascular damage there. You have a lot of nerves. And it takes a long time to heal those ligaments.
Now, instead of nursing interventions, do the nurses know, are they allowed to just go ahead and put those on without orders?
It depends on where you work. Like in the emergency room, some of the nurses, if you're trained to do that, yes.
Like you're trained in that specialty?
Not even as an EMT is trained, but not to put those type of splints on. No. In the hospital, it's different. Each unit, like the orthopedic unit, allows their nurses to do certain splinting immobilization. Right. In the emergency room, the nurses are trained to do only certain types of splinting and immobilization. You only can do what you're trained to do in the area you work in. So you would find out whatever hospital you work in or whatever unit.
So it's policy.
It's all policy. They do. It's really to protect us. But to be honest with you, most times nurses, we end up readjusting, like because when we move them a lot with bed care and all that, their AM care. So you usually have to maybe just tighten up something, readjust. But you're usually not the one putting the initial splint on. You end up fiddling with a lot, definitely. And if you're trained, by all means, yes, then you can. In certain areas, like I said, the emergency room, we have our nurses that work in ER too, and the majority of what the patients they have are fractures, sprains, strains, so they're very proficient in it. But so are the techs are excellent. So it's, you know, we have the orthopedic techs. But some hospitals may have the nurses doing more if they don't have as many services available. This is another one that you've probably seen, the knee immobilizer that goes on the lower leg. It has the firm rods on the side. Basically, would just go right on your whole leg. And you really just want to make sure that, you know, you have the hole where the knee is so you can see the knee. You know, always be able to check pulses above and below. And it just velcros right around the side. And there's numerous sizes of this to fit The doctor will write the order for what kind of splints that they want. Sometimes the splints they want are things that we don't even have in the hospital that the techs can put on, and we do have companies that come in and put on, you know, these special devices that the doctors might order. CPM, right, yes. Continuous passive motion machine, and you've seen that, and it's for the knee injuries or the knee surgeries, and it allows flexion and extension of the knee so that they get their continuous movement for healing. You should always check on the foot.
Above?
Yeah, and the femur.
You would just check the femur?
Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of times people put splints on, they don't put them on properly. They're on too tight. Mm-hmm. They're cutting off the circulation. You know, it's a beautiful splint. It could probably win an award, but it's got, you're actually compressing an area, so it's very important to always check neurovascular status before and after you do any kind of intervention. The sling and the swath, we've all seen, you have a lot of times put the sling on, you can have it on just this way, crisscross it around the back, or you can have one where you actually, some of you might have seen, did you see this when you were at BRIC? This one where the whole arm is in there, this is the one where... Then you have that pin as it goes around, and there's usually a little pin. I think we've used this thing so many times that it actually hangs up on a pole and on a weight to keep it fully immobilized. When we talk about a swath, a sling and swath, we're talking, this is the sling that's on, and this is the swath, which goes around it. When you see it wrapped around their chest, this one's all attached, but that's what it is. So this would be completely wrapped around me, and then it would crisscross in the front so that I couldn't move it all this way.
Is that for, like, rotor cuffs?
Shoulder, rotor cuff, humerus. You don't want any of that movement. And this stays on when they're in bed. And this does move a lot. So that's why you want to always keep an eye on that, because as you move them or they have anything done, it's going to slide, it's going to get loose. You know, and we have, you'll see, you'll have patients that usually don't always have just one injury, so... Yes, just think about in there, it gets sweaty, dirty, you know, if they have a cut with it, a laceration, a lot of diaphoresis or sweating, so you want to have good skin care, make sure it stays nice and clean. These do really smell after a while. The odor can become atrocious. So if it gets really bad, really soiled, they may, you know, just discard it and get a whole new splint if it becomes that saturated, and that does happen with a lot of our patients. And the only other immobilization you might have is for your collars. This is called a Philadelphia collar, and this is for the neck injury. This is to, it doesn't stabilize it, it just supports it. And this is a little firmer than you have your stiff neck collar that you see in the field that has the rigid piece in it. This doesn't really have a rigid piece. It's kind of soft and flexible. But these do tell you if they're, which one goes on the back, which one goes on the front. You can't forget where the chin is. And the only thing you need to know about these, it has moleskin in it, which people that have an allergy to latex cannot tolerate this. So if they do have that allergy to latex, we just usually pop that out. So if you have them, what we do is you just slide, you slide the front up under the chin, and then the back would go right behind. And once it's behind my neck, then you just velcro the two pieces together. Yeah. Well, you know.
We actually had to go out and buy a whole new chair, like a recliner. Like, you can't sit. Like, you have this big, huge thing. So people that have those things, there's no way to.
Comfortable, no, because you think that you have this in your, you have the piece in your chin, but you have this digging right into the back of your occipital area. And then what happens when people are in bed a lot of times, this happens. And if that doesn't dig into your back while you're laying flat. So always be careful, and that's why it's good to turn them, check, make sure you don't have things, bent up.
When people are wearing things like this, or like your husband, they get fatigued because they become sleep.
Right, you can't sleep.
They cannot find a comfortable position to sleep in, and then they get irritable and frustrated. I mean, it really just kind of compounds itself.
It does. And you may have a lot of your orthopedic patients may have, a neck injury with also some of their extremity injuries. And that's why I thought it would be good to show you. You have the pillow. We also have a little head cradle, we call it. It's a foam pad. It's about this big and has a hole in the middle so that when they're laying in bed, the back of this would sit right in there so that they have, and that helps people a lot too. So too late for him now, but we Probably could have gotten him one of them to sleep with at home.
Well, you know, he had cervical fusion in both areas, and he was only in the hospital. I mean, they sent him home so fast, so he was actually more comfortable, like, in hospital. Once you get home, you're, like, on your own. Three days, you're home.
Right.
You know, they got him out and moving around.
Up and moving it. And, right, this is usually, again, just to immobilize, doesn't stabilize a fracture, or usually they've gone to the OR, they've had it repaired. This is just to stabilize it while it heals.
Yeah.
This is called the Philadelphia collar. There's a couple different kinds. In the hospital, if you have anybody, they're supposed to date it and time it when it's put on. And when it gets soiled, or every 5 days, we're supposed to change it because it's also a big breeding ground for infection.
Do they take it off at all for any kind of hygiene?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. If they need full support, right, you can hold their head, stabilize them, take this off completely, clean around the neck. It'll be written on the order whether or not you can remove it or not to do your care. But it can be removed as long as someone, you know, manually holds, stabilizes, right. You have to get in there because that's, you know, you think about all the things they could. And that's a Philly collar.
People crazy when they get itchy.
Right. And they start wiggling around. And these are the soft collars. You've probably seen these a lot. These are used for support, too. What's nice with these, they come with a little sleeve. So if it gets soiled, then you can put, you know, sleeve on and get a little more use out of it. But they too, where the groove of the neck is, goes right down around and then it attaches. Now there's different sizes of the soft collar. Again, this is just to give a little extra support too. It doesn't provide any immobilization though whatsoever. That one comes in different sizes. This comes in different sizes. And the only person you might see this on, I don't think they'd be on the floor with anybody with a craniotomy, but they will put it on backwards for someone with a craniotomy so that they can't flex their head back after they've had some neurosurgeries. So these are the soft collars, but as you know, anything with Velcro, if you haven't realized it already, picks up everything. Sticks to everything, stick to you, stick to... So that's called a soft cervical collar. Don't go that way.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry? Are they on Brennan 5 going to orthopedic floor again, or that was it? And that was... So tomorrow's back to Brennan 6. I think that's it, but I can leave these here if you want. Anybody wants to look at these later. Other medical management, they may need surgery. There are multiple different types of surgeries that they can have, rotting, pinning, wiring, screws, plates, nails, you name it, they can do it. So it's amazing what can be done. Traction, it may be needed to reduce something, to immobilize it, also to control muscle spasms. A lot of times, if you can control the muscle spasms, you can control the pain because that gives people a lot of pain. And we've all had muscle spasms and know how much they can really, really hurt.
Has anybody in your OR rotation been into orthopedic surgery at all?
No, they don't.
They usually don't.
They'll let you go in?
They're not going to be easy surgery.
Yeah. Yeah, they're usually not quick surgeries.
No, they're not. But the equipment that they have in there, it looks like you're in a workshop.
Yes.
It's exactly like what you have in your garage.
Your tool shed, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly what you have in your garage, except that it's all stainless steel.
It's sterile, right? You saw the Greenfield filter. Was that in the OR?
Mm-hmm.
And when had they done, repaired the hip also, in the, or that was already done prior? Yeah, so
my
that's...
husband, I'm going to give up traction, sorry, had his neck surgery.
Mm-hmm.
They actually, he had it done at the one at Holmdale, the hospital at Holmdale, and they had students.
Bayshore.
Students, and they all came in to see him afterwards, and they all looked at him and said, we cannot, you would never believe, they said to me, you never believe in a million years what they did to you. On the table. The neck, they explained to him what they did, because he wants to know everything. They actually pull his legs and they stretch the neck, and because they have to open everything in here to take out or fuse. And they said they couldn't believe when they saw him that he wasn't like screaming and yelling. They said the way they twisted him and pulled him, and because you're dealing with here,
right,
they have
you
to
know,
open
very large space.
Everything up.
Well, they give you enough medication, you'll move in any position they want.
Yeah, because, you know, it's so tiny in there.
Yeah, it really is.
And
you know, a lot of important things in there.
Oh,
yeah.
That
you have to be able to visualize.
And they go through, which I never realized, that they go through your throat. They go through the front.
To get to the back, yes.
They go through your front to get to the back.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you, you know, this is all compromised, now you got this wall. It's a lot of care.
It is.
A lot of intense anything with that.
With the neck area, right? A small area to work in. Was he, and so that's why he was in the Philly collar for a while.
Yeah. It was a miserable.
did he have drains?
And he had everything.
Yes.
He had all kinds of drains, but the surgeon who did it, I'll tell you, he has not one scar in his neck. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. You would never even know he had it. It's amazing what they could do now.
Yeah, they do. And a lot of reconstruction they can do. A lot of grafting they do now so that people don't look, you know, they can.
You'd never know. You would never know he had that surgery. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
It is. The skin tractions are different types, though. You saw this was the Buck's traction that we use for the hip, probably the most common one you'll see. The Russell's is really for the tibia, pelvic traction, back. Dunlap, they call it, when they put the arm up in the air for the humerus fracture. And when you're on the orthopedic floors, there's always references for you to look things up. You know, you can go on the computer and always look things up, or they usually have charts and different things there you can review so you know exactly what type. And there's so many, and I'm sure it'll keep changing. The open wounds, we talk about how dirty they are, that you need a lot of times we get a wound culture on those, so when they get to the floor, you may see, you know, that they had a wound culture done. Maybe they want a repeat wound culture done if things start to look like it's getting worse or it's infected. It has to be irrigated, antibiotics, and make sure that you inspect those dressings regularly. Make sure you're not getting a lot more drainage, a lot more oozing, and that the swelling is not really increasing. Thank you. For the amputated part, you want to control the active bleeding, elevate the stump. We usually wrap it in gauze, you know, we have the gauze with normal saline and wrap it in that, and you never put it directly on ice. You want to make sure it's kept cool to maintain perfusion and circulation, but never freeze it, so you don't want to get a bag of ice. We always laugh in the field, it's hard to get ice, so it's like you're going to drive to 7-Eleven and get a bag of ice, but most times, unfortunately, most of the parts that are amputated are not usually in one piece like that and intact that you can bring in, but you want to wrap them, keep it as sterile as you can with normal saline, and then put it either on ice packs or on something
that's
cool.
The actual stump.
The stump itself, right. The stump itself. Don't lose it. You get it. But the radiographs, prepare them for x-rays. They may be admitted to the hospital they originally are at, or they maybe have to transfer it. And sometimes it's not for reattachment. Sometimes it's just to have reconstructive vascular surgery that might need to be done. So there's different specialties, different facilities, and we've been able to do some repairs at Jersey Shore. Some of them we have to send out afterwards for additional surgeries or reconstructive surgeries. Years ago, Bellevue, everybody went to Bellevue. That was the top place. And time is of the essence. You know, the sooner they get there, the better chance they have. So we usually try to get them moving. Antibiotics, they need to, and also prophylaxis. The crush injury we talked about the other day. You know, the only thing I didn't mention with the amputated patients, you want to elevate the stump that's left. You want to try to, you know, don't forget to take care of that because that area too needs to get good perfusion. So if you have a dressing on that, make sure that it's, you know, clean and that the drainage is not increasing, that doesn't get infected. A lot of times we'll get that phantom pain feeling. They still feel like the limb's attached. And that's because some of the nerve sensations are still there and haven't been completely destroyed. So don't be surprised if they tell you that they feel that phantom, and it's called the phantom limb type of sensation. So it's more common if it's a complete amputation when it's been a guillotine type where it's completely severed and some of those nerves haven't totally been destroyed. They may complain of also some tingling, burning pressure occasionally in the stump area and even some pain. It's because of the whatever nerve endings are left. That's the sensation that they feel. So still medicate them for pain as you would, you know, any of your other patients, and understand that that is real to them. Although we don't see anything there, they still indeed do have those feelings and sensations are real to them. Crush injury, we talked about giving crystalloid fluids. And what's one of the crystalloids? Ringer's lactate or normal saline, right? Good. And you want to get rid of the myoglobin that's now clumped up so that it doesn't bind and totally block your renal tubules. Elevate the extremity, keep the wounds clean. You want to keep reassessing the urine output. One, are they urinating? What's the average urination we expect for an adult?
What's the
minimum?
30 an hour,
right. We like to see at least one cc an hour, 1 mL an hour, but we like to have 30, I'm sorry, is as the minimum that we want to have. You want to look at their motor and sensory function, how much myoglobin's in the urine, and what color will that myoglobin turn the urine?
Brown.
Right, it'll be a brownish color. Right, they may have to go to the OR, and you want to make sure they're well hydrated, fluids, and also, you know, through the IV and drinking fluids. Yeah, it's 1 cc per kilogram per hour is what we want to expect for the urine output, is what our goal is, 30 being the minimum bare minimum that you want to go by. Elevate the limb to level of the heart. You want to assist with compartment pressures, 35 to 45. They're going to be in the OR, hopefully getting that fasciotomy, and then you want to always keep reassessing neurovascular, and that's checking for pulses, checking for skin temperature, checking for mobility and sensation. 5 P's, we talked about, very important, but always make sure that you monitor their overall status. Airway is always number one. Breathing, we want to make sure that that's being controlled. That, make sure we didn't over-medicate them, and now they're breathing about 6 times a minute. So take care of the pain, but keep an eye on that breathing. And sometimes that does happen. Sometimes, you know, you load them up, and we snow them, and some people can't tolerate a lot of pain medication. They've never had it before. So one injection for them. So you always, very, very important, keep an eye on respirations and breathing status, just so that if they've had too much, you can reverse it, or maybe next time don't be giving them the full amount.
The people from that, Petco explosion, did they come to Jersey?
Yes, we got three.
Were there four altogether, or three out of four?
We had 3 out of 4, and Monmouth Med received 2. And the 3 that we got, the one person, he had a fractured foot. He had probably multiple fractures in that one foot. Abrasions and scrapes. The other gentleman had a open femur, and then the last person, the girl, had bilateral crushed legs. Yes. She didn't come in till 5 o'clock.
What I saw was that it exploded.
Yeah, she was down in the basement. And so was the first gentleman, but he was making his way out, so he was close to the door. I guess they had smelled the gas and were trying to get out. They weren't open for business, and that was the big concern, because if that store had ever been opened and people were in there, it would have been a disaster. And then we thought at first that it was PetSmart, not Petco, and the PetSmart is in a mall that's attached to Staples, Home Depot, and a parking lot full of cars, and it happened at like 11 o'clock. So it was a very busy time. And on Saturdays at Petco, what they do is they restock on Fridays, and then on Saturdays they have the pet adoption and all their different services. So thank God it could have really been a disaster.
It happened at what time?
11 o'clock in the morning.
And they weren't open.
Yeah. They were doing construction, and they were doing something because one of the girl that was most seriously injured was not, that wasn't her regular store. She was there doing something. I mean, that's fate, sadly, that, you know, she was
at 11 and you didn't get her till 5. So that's how long it took to get her out.
Mm-hmm. To get her out. Get her out, so not good for those lower legs now. Both of them. So I didn't see. I honestly don't know. I didn't see her, but I think I don't know how far up, to be honest with you. But it was both legs, and sadly, and the majority was because she was pinned in that same position for so long. It's
so what's one organ system they will be very carefully assessing here?
Right.
Kidneys.
Very good. Very good. And with most trauma patients, anyone, we always call it the golden hour. The sooner the hour is what your goal is, to get them into the hospital to get whatever they need done. After that, then they may survive, but then the long-term effects can be much more significant. So she, thank God for, you know.
Is she a young person?
She was young, yeah. She's in, I think, in her 30s.
Oh,
yeah, definitely. And even with, you know, there are prostheses. There's a lot of things they can do now, and she will think. And it's amazing to me that they even survived. When you look at the mechanism there and how the whole building just collapsed and they were downstairs, you know, they were really very lucky. You know, and I don't think any of the gas company men were injured, but he was.
Were they on site at the time?
Well, they hit the pipe.
Yeah.
They were behind it.
There
was question whether a gas line was not legally marked on the map blueprint, or did they hit it by accident? So, and apparently the guy on the tractor, luckily he was the only one that may have had like a flash type of burn, but he went to Monmouth. We didn't see him, but lucky for the snow for him, he was able to just like throw himself, you know, in the snow to stop that burning process. But yeah, and I thought that maybe 2 had come to Monmouth, but we didn't know how many people were getting it first.
They have
the fire departments have heavy rescue, And some of the towns have, in addition to other rescue teams, and what they usually, they have airbags, they have jaws, they're like spreaders, they can spread metal. And then the airbags, you can lift a lot of things quite heavy. So I'm not sure what exactly they had to use for them. And I know they had to get a lot of the large debris off, so I'm sure they had the tractors and everything else in there. But it was pretty scary there, and we thought, you never know what you're going to get. So both hospitals, Monmouth and Jersey Shore, had their disaster teams activated, and because we could have had 5 people or we could have had 50.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you don't know.
They had medevac. First they said they were, and it's amazing how the stories keep changing. And first we were getting 2, then we were getting 4, then we were getting 2 by air, then we were getting 3 by air. Nobody came by air. Everybody came by So, we had enough people in the trauma room to, sink the Titanic. But it's better to be overprepared and have enough. And so you never know.
Does your adrenaline kick in when you get the call?
Yes.
Emotionally?
Usually, yeah. That's kind of the way I am. I like that. That's not that it's, but it's something that I like, the challenge. I like that, it's the fear of the unknown. You never know what you're going to get. You could be fine 1 minute, and then you could be hit. So, the sadness is hard. The emotional part, to me, is very difficult, and that's why sometimes I've had to step away from it, because you can only see so much death, tragedy, and, that kind of thing really bothers me. But as far as getting in there and the action and everybody working together is nice to see, because when you have a good system in place and you'll learn a lot from different places and you'll see hospitals that have a run well, like the trauma team at Jersey Shore functions extremely well. And it's just a systematic, and everybody kicks in, which is nice to see. And the ER, we mobilized, we did what we had to do, and that's what you have to do. Now we're preparing. They're having a big drill in April, a top-off 3 drill, in case there's a they still have this war concern that we're going to be hit with an epidemic of some sort, and what they really think is going to be not the chicken pox, but not smallpox, not the anthrax. I can't forget. Now I'm so fixed on the musculoskeletal, but it's something that if we're all exposed to it, the big concern is that we as healthcare workers then could bring it home to our families. So, and if your families are in jeopardy, none of us are going to be in the hospitals working. And they're being realistic about it, which is, so they're trying to prepare for that in case, God forbid, it ever does happen.
There's something very satisfying about that level of teamwork.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That works together. And that doesn't just happen.
Right.
That has to be designed and worked on to make that happen. And it has to do with recognizing your role and knowing the priorities and knowing all those things and working together as a unit.
It's very, very important, and that's what I think how we function as well as we do now, because when it's chaotic and there's no organization and people aren't well trained, things don't work. But that day worked very well. We were actually relieved that we didn't get 50, because we had a big class going on that day too.
Friday
we were doing a trauma class, and we were trying to get extra stretchers for the class, and of all days you think, no, this can't be a real, because a lot of times the medics will go out on a call and they'll tell us they have something, and it ends up being fizzles out. But this is definitely, so they were lucky, and that can happen. The 5 P's: pain, pallor is right, the color, sensation, pulses, do they have pulses, what's the quality of those pulses? And then again, you're always looking at one extremity to the other, and how equal are they? Paresthesia, when you have that numbness or tingling, you have sensory loss. Paralysis, when you have the motor, loss of motor function. Not to be gruesome, here's a picture of the patient with an external fixator. You can see the rod across the top there. It's going right through each one of his hips. That's a pretty extensive. That's put in the OR, and you can see with a hip or a pelvis fracture like that, you can see all the swelling that you get. That's normal. That's expected. That will go away.
That's a scrotum,
and that's how bad the swelling gets with an injury like that. So to him, them may be devastating. You may have some trouble with urine output initially, and that fixator is he's got the Philly collar. I don't know if you can see it. See it up there also. He's also got an arm splint of some sort on there, but that is a very stable splint. So
this looks like he was hit.
Yeah, he could have been hit head on there. Usually a pelvis fracture. An unstable pelvis fracture has to be have skeletal traction on to heal properly.
They'll do that right away?
Take him right to the operating room. Do that, yes.
They do that in the OR?
Yes. It's called an external fixator. That's what that is, and that's you can most commonly used for the pelvis type of fractures, especially an unstable one.
That would take very, very careful surgical and depth assessment to make sure that extent of organ damage.
Right, right, because with the pelvis, you're always concerned. Now, he'll be probably in the ICU for several days on his anticoagulants, but you watch after a couple days. That thing, he won't even know he has it on because they move around like, you know, wiggle worms. Yeah, you're like, you know, keep still. But you have a lot of jagged edges here, so just be careful, too, if you're taking care of them. You don't want to poke yourself. You can easily get hurt. They can catch themselves on the bed and a lot of different
mattresses.
The swelling will go down. Right. Right. It goes down on its own. It's just an immediate thing that will happen, so don't be, like, devastated when you see
that's
it. Because any questions on anything we covered? No? Okay. Well, thank you. Now I get to turn it over to Professor. Oh, the only thing, we talked about the fat emboli, and with any type of those fractures, always keep that in the back of your mind. Those are the life-threatening things. We talked about soft tissue. We talked about immobility. But the biggest complication you always worry about with the musculoskeletal injury is a fat emboli from the bone, the large bones primarily, the femur, pelvis, or a air embolus. You can also get a small clot to a blood clot. So that's always a big concern in the back of your mind with musculoskeletal injuries, and it can be life-threatening. So that's why they get the Flotrons, the little half boots, get those on. Even if they only have one on, it's a benefit. So you may see patients that have a broken leg on one side, but on the other leg they have the Flotron on. They rarely put them on the arms. It's just you're getting that circulation going. The trauma patients, we don't usually put on heparin because you don't want them to bleed their other injuries. So, but if your orthopedic patients, you may have them on heparin or Lovenox, or you may have them on Coumadin just to keep their blood nice and thin.